historical perspective on the January 6 insurrection. On the one-year anniversary of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, we are still trying to understand how it happened and how the nation moves forward. To some, it was a seminal and terrifying moment that revealed how fragile our democracy really is. To others, it was a defining moment in the fight to take back what they saw as an illegitimate election, despite the complete lack of evidence. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we turn to history to try and understand what January 6, 2021 means and what we as citizens need to do to mend the nation. Our guests, author and historian Kenneth C. Davis and Bowdoin political science professor Andrew Rudalevich. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by listeners and by Maine General Health, a comprehensive system for all your health care needs. Learn more at MaineGeneral.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. 1 year ago, we watched in horror as a mob took siege of the nation's capital. Today, we're going to put the events of that day, or we're going to try to put the events of that day into historical perspective. My guest today, Kenneth C. Davis, best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History series. And he also wrote the acclaimed In the Shadow of Liberty and Strong Man, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. Also with us, Andrew Rudalevich, the chair of the Bowdoin College Department of Government and Legal Studies. He focuses on American political institutions and the presidency. In his recent book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. We invite you to join the conversation. What are you thinking about today as you reflect back on January 6th, 2021. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. Happy New Year. Thank you so much for being here today. I know that 1 year out, by a historian's perspective, is not very far, Kenneth Davis. But I need to ask you, as you look back, I'm thinking to myself, history is already being rewritten. There are already people who are trying to change the story of what we saw on television just a year ago.
It's very true, Jen. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure, and Happy New Year to you as well. I did listen to President Biden today. I'm sure we'll come back to that conversation as well. But I'm reminded of something another president said a long, long time ago, before he became president. John Adams said, "Facts are stubborn things." And that's always uppermost in my mind as a historian, as somebody who wants to set the record straight. I've spent 30 years, more than 30 years, I hate to say, as a historian, trying to correct a historical record, fill in the gaps that we left in history, and teach some of the stories that our school books leave out. And we are watching, as it happens, the history of 1 year ago being rewritten. Unfortunately, for those who would like to rewrite it, we have the receipts, as is popular say these days. We know what happened on that day. It's quite irrefutable. We're still learning a great deal more about what led up to that day, but the facts of that day can't be denied. They can't be rewritten. And we are entitled to opinions, but we are not entitled to facts, certainly not as historians.
Andrew Rudalevich, what are you thinking about today?
Well, I'm thinking about January 6th as part of a larger trend, I think, over the last number of decades, really, in American history, as we begin to grow more and more polarized, apart from each other in terms of our beliefs, but also in terms of our affect, our emotions towards members of the public with whom we disagree. I think that's an important part of this story more broadly. There's a post-war era of comity, you might say, when there's quite a lot of unity. Now, part of that is because of the sort of ability to keep contentious issues like civil rights, for example, off the table. But a lot of what we think about American politics is driven by that era, this era of sort of unity. And yet, the breadth of American history suggests that we've often been contentious, and we have had, you know, many moments in our history where we've been quite brutal towards each other. And I know that Joe Biden's speech today was trying to recapture that moment of unity and trying to battle for broader democracy. But I think we need to take a serious look at, the breadth of our history here.
Yes, I'm going to pile in on what Andrew just said there. We have a long and not noble tradition of mob violence in this country. Again, sometimes the stories the school books leave out. One can go back to the 1830s when mobs burned abolitionist literature in South Carolina and then went and killed an abolitionist publisher named Elijah Lovejoy from Maine. That's right, a Mainer. He was an abolitionist who was essentially murdered by a mob who wanted to destroy his printing presses. We go to the Civil War, the draft riots here in New York City of 1863, when mostly white Irish men did not take to the idea of being drafted to fight to free the enslaved people in the South, and they went about hanging a great many of them and murdering them. I can go down a long list of these, but mob violence is unfortunately as American as apple pie and lynching. And so we have to take that into account. We like to have this pretty picture of our history, a question that's being debated very hotly right now, especially in schools, about what history we teach. But history always has to be grounded in facts and accuracy. We can't just paint a pretty patriotic picture of the past and expect that to be the one we adhere to. And certainly, we cannot erase the events of 1 year ago that we all saw. George Orwell, who we've all been reading a great deal of these days, was very clear on how a party in power, a single party in power, can erase history by throwing it down the memory hole. We're very, very in dangerous waters if we get to that point, obviously.
Andrew.
Yeah, just to pick up on the point, I don't want to downplay, in a way, the singular nature of January 6th or its importance. Right, it's an attack on the Capitol, which of course has symbolic as well as practical value. It's an attack on a democratic, small d democratic process, a constitutional process of finalizing the results of what, in fact, was a free and fair presidential election. And if you look at commentary, bipartisan commentary from that day and just after, right, you do get a sense of the shock to the system that it entailed, not just for Democrats, but for, Republicans as well. And you see that, in terms of even, Mitch McConnell, for example, as he is voting to acquit Donald Trump, right, of responsibility for that event, is saying, Donald Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of that day. He calls it terrorism, right? And, a year later, we have seen a real process of moving away from that kind of attribution of responsibility. The parties have diverged quite dramatically, of course. And so, I do think, again, coming back to Ken's point about, not allowing the facts to be shifted in retrospect, I think we do need to be honest about, what happened then and not try to normalize it as part of our political discourse.
I want to ask you, Ken, though, you make the very good point that mob violence is all over American history. Obviously, great division. The Civil War is the big example. But is there another example of an American president calling into question the results of an election? And in this kind of way, or anything at this scale that an historical precedent for this level of popular disbelief in the very foundation of our democracy?
Well, we can certainly go back to what was really the first contested presidential election in 1800, without going too deep into the weeds of presidential elections. The events that year, which have become much better known because of a Broadway musical called Hamilton, are essentially that Thomas Jefferson, who was the sitting vice president, was running against the sitting president, John Adams, who previously mentioned. And because of the electoral rules at that time, later changed, essentially John Thomas Jefferson and his putative running mate, Aaron Burr, finished in a tie. John Adams was left, the incumbent president was left out of the picture. There was a real struggle over who was going to become the next president. Jefferson had, by all rights, a good case to make. He thought Burr was just going to go ahead. And so there was a lot of backroom dealing until finally, after many, many votes, the House of Representatives decides that Thomas Jefferson will be the third American president. But it went a long time, and there were rumblings of troops in the street at a certain point. That's the nearest we can come to this. It was, of course, settled peaceably. It resulted in the passage of the 12th Amendment to sort out separating the presidential election from the vice presidential election. So it was one of those perfect examples of how democracy, a very early democracy, was tested and came through strengthened, just the way President Biden today was speaking about how democracy has been strengthened in the past. Unfortunately, in the last 30 years, we saw democracy seemingly triumphant. But since then, and particularly in the last 20 years or so, I think we've seen American democracy threatened at its very fundamental basis by a number of issues. Of course, there have been other contested presidencies, two in particular, but none of them rose to putting the actual fate of the election and the fate of the democracy at risk the way the January 6th insurrection did.
Andrew Rudilevich, do you worry about the fate of the democracy?
Well, I always worry about the fate of democracy. It rests on people's actions, you know, at the very local level all the way up. You know, I think people need to believe that they have a voice and that their voice counts. And of course, attacking the integrity of the election process is problematic in that it begins to erode people's faith. And what's your answer if you feel something's been stolen from you is to act and perhaps, you know, to tell yourself that it's legitimate to act violently. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a, you know, what I'm most worried about, I guess, is people beginning to lose faith that elections are free and fair in this country and that therefore it's legitimate for people to take things into their own hands. And so of the various, you know, responses to January 6th and to the accusations, you know, which have never been shown to have any evidence behind them, 60 plus courts looked at these charges of electoral fraud, for example, and rejected them uniformly, I should say. And so I guess the what's coming out in terms of state level changes to election law, not so much in terms of things like, you know, regulating mail-in ballots or, you know, drop boxes, that kind of thing. I mean, we can talk about whether those are good ideas or not, but the broader effort to bring elections under partisan control in a number of states, I think, has more problematic aspects, given what the, you know, the avowed plan of those who wanted to block certification of the electoral votes on January 6th was. That plan was to have the states come back and cast multiple slates of electors, thereby making it very hard to know what the correct outcome was. again, the 2020 election, by the way, not all that close in historical terms, certainly not like 1800, 1824, 2000 more recently, right? And in those cases, earlier cases, right, as Ken said, you know, we can look to, you know, 1960, an election that was extraordinarily close. And yet the losing candidate, Richard Nixon, in that case, the sitting vice president, accepted the result of that election, endorsed it. 2000, again, the sitting vice president, Al Gore, endorsed a decision at the Supreme Court that had gone against him with regards to the counting of Florida's votes then. You know, 2020 in that sense is a very different animal, and one that has spawned further action, again, mostly at the state level, which does concern me.
I'm going to go to Tom, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Good morning. Thank you. It seems to me that we can talk about a difference of opinion and comparing different events in history, but we also have to factor in personality and talk about the individuals involved. In this case, with Donald Trump, we're talking about a very pathological and compromised personality, and it needs to be recognized. It's not just another incident of mob violence in America.
Kenneth C. Davis.
Yes, I don't know if there was a question in there, but my reaction to it is certainly when we talk about history, we are not just talking about movements and what people are doing. We are often talking about individuals and what human beings do. My recent book, Strongman, I go through the stories of five men who were responsible for the doing these things. So one has to always take into account the personalities who are on the scene at any given time. Part of the point of that book is also, by the way, that democracy does not die in darkness. All tribute to the Washington Post. I subscribe to it. I read it regularly. But democracy often dies in broad daylight, usually with thousands of people cheering it on. Mussolini in Italy, Adolf Hitler in Germany, came to power in elected positions under constitutional democracies. They showed how quickly, now they were new and shaky democracies, admittedly, but they showed how quickly democracy can disappear if we allow it to. So without getting into the personalities, certainly the personality here is significant, because this is a person, the former president, who is quite unique in many respects in modern, certainly in modern American politics. One of the extraordinary exceptional things about America is that for all of the crises we've had, we have never turned to a strong man, an authoritarian, even though people have claimed certain presidents are dictators, they have not been. In our two greatest moments of crises, in fact, 1860, we get Abraham Lincoln, and then in 1932, we get Franklin D. Roosevelt. People didn't like a lot of the things they did. Some of them even called them tyrants and dictators, but certainly there were men who expanded democracy and the ideas of democracy rather than trying to limit it. That exceptionalism was certainly missing in the previous administration.
Tom, thank you for your call. And we do need to go to a break. We are talking, of course, about the 1 year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. If you want to join the conversation, send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Murray Plum and Murray's Estate Planning Group, helping protect family properties and legacies. Learn more at npmlaw.com.
Prices are going up, yes, but there is more to it than just that.
The problem is that people have a harder time putting rising prices in the context of the broader economy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the American Inflation Disconnect. The rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street as well. Next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace today at 6:30. A special thanks to David Avery from Westport Island, Maine, for donating his 2002 Honda Accord. Donated cars, trucks, and SUVs make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station. And the Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program makes it easy. Towing is free, and that great feeling you get for supporting the programming you enjoy is priceless. If you're wondering what to do with your unneeded vehicle, please visit Maine Public's Vehicle Donation Program. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about the insurrection 1 year ago, its place in history, and its lasting impacts. My guest, Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, Andrew Rudalevich, and best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History series, Kenneth C. Davis. Share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Maine Secretary of State, Shenna Bellows. Shenna, thanks for calling in.
My pleasure.
Shenna, I understand January 6th spurred you and several other secretaries of state across the country to think deeply about voter rights and to take action. Tell us what is happening in Maine, what has happened in the last year, and what you plan to do this year.
Thank you so much. So as Secretary of State, it's been a great honor to work with secretaries of state across the country from both the Republican and Democratic parties to look at what happened in 2020 and what we can do to continue to strengthen our elections to ensure free, fair, and secure elections always. And one of the things that we've observed that concerns me in the wake of the events of January 6th last year, the attempt and the violent attempt to overthrow the results of the election, is that we have seen waves of violence against local elected officials and secretaries of state, including at least two incidents here in Maine directed against municipal clerks. Across the country, we've seen hundreds of bills introduced to restrict voting rights. At least 19 states have passed 34 laws restricting the rights of American citizens to vote. And finally, we've seen a trend of election subversion bills with a goal of partisan interference in election administration itself and certification of results after the election. So what we're doing in Maine in response to these trends to strengthen and protect our democracy are two things. First, we are working with Representative Bruce White to advance legislation to protect our election workers from threats, to make it a crime to threaten election officials or attempt to disrupt election activities. And then second, we're working with Representative Teresa Peirce to protect the integrity of ballots and voting equipment from outside partisan interference by third parties, like the fraudulent activity that we saw in Arizona. So those are two state-level initiatives. We're also working, calling on, and again, these are bipartisan efforts to encourage the United States Senate to advance the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, because in Maine, we're third in the country in voter participation right now. We do things extraordinarily well, but state after state continues to restrict the right of their own citizens to vote, and that is not okay. So we also need federal action.
Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, I'm going to give our guests a chance to ask you a question. And going first to author Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About History books. Ken, what do you want to ask Shenna Bellows?
Thank you, Madam Secretary. It's a pleasure. And I appreciate your very, very powerful statements about bipartisanship. I will be the skunk at the garden party here, however, and say that most of those efforts that you are describing to overturn rights are really coming from one party, not both parties. And I'm specifically concerned about the idea that legislatures could reject the results of the election. We are seeing that happen so that a Secretary of State in another state could conceivably say, no, we're going to throw that out and put up the other board of electors. So that's a really, really troubling notion. And I'd like to know how you see that playing out. Thank you.
I think you're absolutely right to mention this point about essentially election hijacking by partisan officials. So what we've seen is 17 states over the last year have passed laws to undermine the tradition of nonpartisan, sometimes quite frankly, and so it should be, boring election administration by nonpartisan election officials and take control by either a state legislature or other partisan actors. So election subversion is a very alarming trend, and we need to be aware of what's happening in those other states. And you're correct. There are, I think that we need to come together around these shared values, Republicans, Democrats, independents. But what we are seeing in many of these other states is coming from an extreme wing of the Republican Party. Former U.S. Senator Bill Cohen, such a revered figure in Maine politics, has spoken very eloquently about this. And I think, you know, I'm a Democrat personally. I think it's important that we reach out to our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. But I also think it's important that Republicans have these conversations within their own party, because traditionally, when you look, for example, at reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, when you look at the Help America Vote Act, when you look at voting rights legislation over time at the federal level, in the Bush administration, the last reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, it was completely bipartisan, unanimous accord that voting rights was worth protecting. And now in this era, given that we've seen the gutting of voting rights and we have what was originally bipartisan legislation, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, there's a reluctance by Republicans to move forward with that, something that wouldn't have been controversial 20 years ago, much less even 10 years ago.
Andrew Rutilevich.
Yeah, Secretary Bellis, thanks for being with us. I'm curious about the role of partisanship in election administration generally. We have seen, of course, some of your colleagues in other states targeted in some ways by state legislation. In Arizona, I believe they removed the Secretary of State from the defense of electoral laws, actually only until the current secretary's term ends, which is a particularly targeted attack on an individual, though in Georgia as well, a Republican legislature removed a Republican Secretary of State from the Board of Elections, right, in presumed retaliation for his unwillingness to go along with some of the claims that were being made about fraud there. So, I mean, there are clearly, you know, aspects of the Secretaries of State's job that brings you into partisan contact. And of course, many of your colleagues are elected. You're selected by the legislature, which is kind of a weird model. Is there a way to keep Secretaries of State, to keep election administration nonpartisan, especially if a state is determined to do that?
I think it's one of the important challenges of our time. And I had the privilege of serving on a bipartisan task force this summer for Republican Secretaries of State, for Democratic Secretaries of State. And we looked at the issue of vote verification. What happens after an election to ensure that the votes were accurate and are fairly counted? And we came up with a unanimous series of recommendations that all states could adopt. That type of work doesn't draw headlines. It doesn't, it's not something that people are always aware of, but that has been my experience, is that there is more that unites to election administration than divides us. And when you look in Maine, for example, we administer elections at the municipal level. There are more than 500 clerks all across the state who work tirelessly to carry out our elections. They come from every political background. And additionally, we have checks and balances in place that people forget. So poll watchers, election observers, representatives from both parties or multiple parties present when the ballots are counted. These are things that are longstanding practices codified in law, not just in Maine, but across the country, that should give people confidence that we do, in fact, have very free, fair, and secure elections. The concern is that those traditions, those laws that were traditionally bipartisan, that have withstood the test of time in states all across the country, those have been eroded over the last year in this partisan effort to change the rules, to try to change the outcome in 2024.
Shana Bellos, thank you so much for calling in. Shana Bellos, Maine's Secretary of State. We're going to go up to Bucksport and talk to David. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. What a pleasure to just having listened to our Secretary of State with all of her wise words that are pertinent to today's issue. I'm most interested in talking about the role of the citizen activist in our participatory democracy. Today is a great day for those of us who want to get out on the streets and sidewalks in various communities. Thousands of people will be in solidarity today as we stand in support of the ongoing work of the investigative committee that will get to the bottom of the insurrection a year ago. I want to invite people in Maine to go to their most regional action that might be planned. I know in Bucksport, the group Solidarity Bucksport, which I'm so proud to be a member of, is having an hour-long demonstration vigil at 5:30 tonight on the little bridge between Bucksport and Verona Island. I'm expecting many, many good folks to come out and stand in solidarity to save our democracy and promote voting rights, promote freedom to vote, promote all of the things that are necessary to keep our democracy intact. The threat from last year's insurrection is clear evidence that it's fragile, and we have to bring citizens out together in the streets to demonstrate the support for an open, free democracy where everyone is allowed to vote. There's no gerrymandering to corrupt the vote. I just want to invite everybody to talk about this issue today. If there's people in their lives that are still believing the lies, we need to talk with them as reasonable human beings and try to bring this nation back to a track of saving the democracy and saving our republic. Join me in Bucksport tonight, 5:30 to 6:30 on the bridge between Bucksport and Verona Island. Stand with Solidarity Bucksport to save our democracy.
All right, David, thank you so much for your call. I have an email here from Rick. If we eliminated the Electoral College and just counted the national popular vote with machine counting of paper ballots required in all states, it would be hard for self-serving crooks like Trump to try stealing an election in broad daylight the way he did. He lost by about 7 million votes. And if he hadn't had the gall to disrupt a largely ceremonial process, none of this totally preventable word I can't say on the radio would have happened on January 6th. Andrew Rudalevich, let's talk about that. Getting rid of the Electoral College, possible, likely, fill in the blank.
Possible, but not likely, because, of course, it would require a constitutional amendment, and that is notoriously difficult to do in terms of the various constituencies you need to mobilize in concert and in coalition to make that happen, right? It requires a vote by Congress, requires votes by a supermajority of the states. And so there is a plan, I guess, for an interstate compact that would allow the states to cast their electoral votes for the winner of the national popular vote. And that would sort of evade the need for constitutional amendment in that if every state followed through on that, if you had a majority of the Electoral College, 270 electoral votes, and those states were pledged to cast those votes for the winner of the national popular vote, then that, I guess, would be sort of a workaround in that the winner of the popular vote would always win the Electoral College. I think there are some issues with that, to be honest. I think it would be very difficult, even for a state that's pledged to do that, to follow through in a case where the person who won the popular vote was extraordinarily unpopular in their state. But that has been proposed. You know, the Electoral College has shifted not so much in its structure. Ken mentioned the 12th Amendment earlier, referred to it in terms of shifting the president and vice president onto separate ballots. But otherwise, we're pretty much working with kind of a jury-rigged system that the framers created, you know, in the famous Committee on Postponed Matters, a committee really that's the epitome of all committees in a certain way. But it was something they couldn't figure out, right? How do we elect the president? And some states at the convention wanted to do it by popular vote. Some wanted Congress to do it. And so the Electoral College turned out to be a little bit of a compromise that everyone could get behind, at least for the purpose of ratifying the Constitution. And, you know, it was originally designed, if you take Alexander Hamilton at face value, right, as independent people making up their mind on behalf of the citizens of their state. But of course, that hasn't been the case for a long time. It's been a partisan vehicle. The people who are selected for the Electoral College, for the most part, are very loyal partisans. And that's designed to prevent there being unfaithful electors in that sense. So, you know, we have a structure that was created some time ago that we've worked with. I think it's, you know, generally people have accepted it, even in cases where the Electoral College has diverged from the popular vote. I have to say, after 2000, there wasn't a huge backlash, even after 2016, where the margin was larger. Not a huge backlash, but certainly the popular vote, to the degree that the House can no longer be seen as representing the majority of the ordinary citizens, which I think is what is in the original design of the Constitution, there's an argument for making the presidency that vehicle and to shifting that to a more national referendum.
Ken Davis.
I agree completely with everything Andrew just said. The piece of legislation that's making its way around the country, I believe, is called the National Popular Vote Act. I believe California passed it a few years ago. It's not that far off. Whether it would be challenged and upheld in court, I would not be able to answer. But it would move away from the need to change the Constitution to rid us of this creation of the late 18th century that is bedeviling us in the 21st century, this idea of the Electoral College. But, you know, in a way, I feel like we're politely talking about, you know, legislative things that we should be doing when we're on a day that we really can't forget what we're talking about here. And I'm reminded of the famous line from by Sean Connery in the movie about Elliot Ness, don't bring a knife to a gunfight. I get the sense from some of the voices that we hear of, you know, let's just sit down and talk to our opposites on the other aisle. We have to remember who we're talking about, the people who were in Congress that day, bludgeoning policemen and threatening to harm the Vice President of the United States and the Speaker of the House. Don't bring a knife to a gunfight is unfortunately something we have to keep in mind. I am not advocating violence. I don't want to say that, but I just wonder what we must really do. And I'm so pleased to hear the caller who said they're going to be out and taking to the streets. Yes, voting is really important, but don't forget that most of the great changes in this country's history came from people who couldn't vote. Black people who couldn't vote helped change those laws. Women who couldn't vote changed the Constitution only 100 years ago, 102 now. So it's really important to remember that even those who can't vote still have a voice in this country, and that this may really require much more aggressive, taking it to the street kind of action from people who are really, really afraid of what we are seeing in the halls of Congress as facts are being pushed aside in the pursuit of a partisan agenda.
We do need to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation on this 1 year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you are quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Birchbrook, an independent financial services company and proud sponsor of Maine Public's 60th anniversary. Birchbrook.com.
I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. NPR's Tom Bowman was on the scene a year ago as insurgents attacked the Capitol.
And I can see people streaming up the stairs onto the plaza of the Senate side of the Capitol itself, and it looks like they're also trying to get into the building.
The anniversary of the January 6th riot, next time on Here and Now.
Join us for Here and Now today at noon. At Maine Public, we're proud to be Maine's storyteller, amplifying the stories and voices of our Maine communities. As a part of our year-long 60th anniversary celebration, we want to hear from you. What voices have you seen or heard on Maine Public over the years that have had a lasting impact on your life? What stories made you laugh, cry, or gave you a new perspective? To learn more and to share your thoughts, visit My Maine Public Story at 60years.mainepublic.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you are listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, 1 year since the Capitol riots. Where are we now as a country? With me, Kenneth C. Davis, historian and author of the Don't Know Much About History series, and Andrew Rudilevich, Thomas Brackett Reed, professor of government at Bowdoin College. Join our conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. And if you are super quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We are going to go up to Harpswell and Jamie. Hi, Jamie, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's always a struggle in any democracy to align the will of the people with the will of the state. And we've seen at moments in history that this need for social cohesion by the party in power has been at odds with a politics of transparency. I think notably this can be seen in the end of the French Revolution, when the Jacobins orchestrated horror through guillotines and then provided an antidote in the form of new modes of representation and constructions of power. So my question is, in this time when we're trying to understand each other or get past this partisanship, is there some sort of sympathy for people who have skepticism now, looking back on history? Like, is it justified? Can we see how a skepticism of modes of media and the need for democracy to have social cohesion, like, could that be at odds with politics of transparency?
I'll jump in on that one, Jen, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I think that it's an interesting point, and obviously we don't want to see, going from a gallows on the National Mall, which we saw 1 year ago, to a guillotine. But that's certainly one of the worst possible outcomes. I wrote in Don't Know Much About History a long time ago that we had entered an era of broken trust late in the 1990s because of the failures of government, the post-Watergate era, the post-911 era. And then we moved from there, I think, to an era of broken democracy. So I think that the caller has touched on something really powerful. We've never been very good in this country at voting. In a good presidential year, we get 60%. That usually falls down to 40% in midterms. We don't have an engaged, civically minded populace for a variety of reasons that didn't start 5 years ago. So I think that there are a lot of pieces to that puzzle. Certainly one of them is the incredible impact of social media as a divisive force in the country right now. We have learned from these Facebook memos that were divulged by the whistleblower in Congress about how this whole thing is built on not just people liking or disliking something, but on their fear and their rage. So we're really at this a terrible moment where a lot of the things that were under the surface throughout American history, and again, we've spoken about some of them, going back to the lynchings and mob riots of the past, to a place where all of that is not only in the public conversation now, it's being amplified very deliberately by this social media. So there are a lot of really big issues that I think that the caller touches on there that are real worries for the democracy. And one of the reasons I'm more pessimistic right now than I have been for most of my adult life.
Jamie, thank you so much for your call. I want to get to this question. Tom on Facebook is asking, but others are asking too. He asks, please explain the difference between insurrection and riot. And Andrew, you know, this is a really important question right now, I think, because there's this poll that's out right now that shows only, I think, 21% of Republicans believe what happened a year ago was an insurrection. And I'm wondering to myself, insurrection is a word that we didn't really even use before a year ago. It was not a word that was in common parlance. So why don't we answer Tom's question? What's the difference between an insurrection and a riot? And why is what happened a year ago an insurrection?
Well, I think the difference would be in the intent in a certain way. A riot could have an intent, right? But in terms of, we usually use that word to describe sort of mindless violence. Perhaps prompted by something that's being responded to, but not with an aim. An insurrection, right, is directed against governing authority, and it implies violence, and it implies an aim of overthrowing that governing authority. And so I think with the January 6th insurrection, I think that's the right word, it implies an organized effort, and the January 6th Commission is trying to get a sense of the scope of that organization. And there are different aspects to it. The 2,000 or so people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, right? They were attempting to prevent the certification of the electoral votes because those votes had come out in a way they didn't like. There was a goal, which was to block the certification. In a way that Mike Pence, the vice president who was presiding over the session, had refused to do, quite rightly, right? He had read his constitution. He had talked to constitutional lawyers. He had ignored the advice of people whose law degrees seem to have been printed on dubious paper. I'm going to single out John Eastman here, who had argued that indeed the vice president could effectively declare the election invalid. In any case, the rioters, even in using that word, right, we see the difficulty of using synonyms, but they were rioting and insurrecting, if that's the verb, almost at the same time, right? There was violence involved. Some of it was mindless. There was attacks on governing authority. You know, 150 police officers and other law enforcement officers were harmed that day. We know, of course, that, several people died as a result of the violence. And it was an insurrection in that it had a purpose. It wasn't a riot in that it was not mindless, even if there were aspects of it that were.
Randy in Poland, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My questions, I think, are a really good spinoff to that. As an independent, I feel like, talking about bipartisanship, but really, I feel like I'm listening to two different narratives, my friends on the left and my friends on the right. It's like they're not even in the same room anymore. And so I was hoping maybe some of your guests could answer some of the, I can just see them foaming at the mouth listening to you guys. So, like, for example, one of the things they might bring up is why all those people were there. And, one of the things I've been told is that a number of the Secretary of States across the country violated their own constitutional laws and basically trying to deal with the COVID outbreak. And, a lot of folks on the right have a problem with that. One of the other things that I think is important to point out as we're using the word insurrection is that my understanding is that no one in the Capitol was actually arrested with a firearm. And the only three people I think that were actually murdered or killed were from Capitol Police. And I think those were all women as well that died that day from that. Another thing that's worth bringing up for me anyway is two things really. There are a number of videos that show Capitol Police actually letting in protesters and rioters, And so there's a wonder, like, what was there no unified response here? Why is it okay to let some in and then, call them all insurrectionist? The other thing that I think is interesting, too, and maybe you can respond to this, is, the violence that did break out of the Capitol that day happened before Donald Trump instructed anyone to march. So, the idea that people were tearing down barricades or anything like that happened well before he said, let's everybody go there. And I
poor
think
Randy, you know what? You have so many questions and we have about 2.5 minutes left in the show. So Ken Davis, do your best. Go ahead.
There's a lot to unpack there. I think that this is, you know, exactly what I was talking about, how social media is kind of taking over the narrative in some respects here. I think we are going to get a lot of answers to some of these questions from what the Congress is duly investigating. We don't know what the Justice Department is doing, but I can be fairly assured that they are not sleeping on their watch here with respect to this. So I think we're going to have a lot of answers. Now, whether the president was still speaking or not when the violence started, what's already very clear and has been established that this was something that happened long before and was planned and sort of given its impetus long before January 6th. It really starts with the president during the campaign itself beginning to cast doubt on the election long before a vote was even cast. So this is really part of a much longer narrative. It didn't start at noontime on January 6th. And I think we have to accept that as a fact. And if you don't, then we can't even have a difference of opinion. We have to agree on facts. The other broader historical point I would come back to, and maybe it's an optimistic one, is we were describing what an insurrection was. There was an insurrection in American history called Shays's Rebellion when we were still governed by the Articles of Confederation. It happened in western Massachusetts, mostly in New England, by disgruntled former veterans of the Revolution who saw that their votes weren't being counted because they couldn't pay their taxes. They took up arms. They were put down. That instance, Shays's Rebellion, was really the impetus that provided for the beginning of the Constitutional Convention. Washington and others looked at this and said, oh my God, what did we fight for if it can come down to this? So our Constitution itself came out of a response to an insurrection. And maybe that's a hopeful piece of history that we can point to, that this insurrection will really inspire people to think more carefully about where this government is heading and how the protections of the Constitution can be guaranteed for all.
We're going to have to end on that hopeful note. And thank you for having a hopeful note, Ken Davis. And thank you both for being our guest today. Kenneth C. Davis, the best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History books and other books, including In the Shadow of Liberty and Strong Man. And Andrew Rudalevich is a professor of history, the Bowdoin College Department of Government and Legal Studies. Sorry, I lost my place there because I was looking for the proper name of your most recent book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Today's sound engineer, KG Akimoladun. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.